Woodrow Wilson, Southern born from Virginia, he had an Atlanta connection, didn't he?
He did have an Atlanta connection. Wilson early on had political ambitions. Being senator of Virginia was actually his highest ambition for a long time. And he thought the way to succeed in politics was to go through the law. So he studied law at the University of Virginia and then moved to Atlanta, where he opened his practice with a friend. He shared an office, and they downtown Atlanta, and Wilson thought that would be the way to get ahead. To be perfectly honest with you, he didn't much like Atlanta, and he definitely didn't like practicing law.
Wilson's actual political experience prior to his election as president was very limited, basically just 2 years as governor of New Jersey. That lack of experience, was that an advantage or a disadvantage for him as president?
Well, I think he would have seen it as neither, and that he paid no attention. I would say, in retrospect, it probably proved to be something of an advantage because he paid no attention to the rules of politics. And in fact, he had less than 2 years' experience. This is the most meteoric rise in American history. Woodrow Wilson was a college professor and president of Princeton in 1910, as late as October of 1910. And in November of 1912, he was elected president of the United States. So in between there, he had a short tenure as governor, where he proved to be an extremely effective and progressive governor, and he applied those same techniques when he became president of the United States, which was to march in with an agenda and just plow forward.
Under his watch in his first term, all sorts of legislation's enacted, the Federal Reserve Act, income taxes brought back, lower tariffs, Federal Trade Commission, child labor laws. Conspicuous by its absence, though, was improved race relations. He was a segregationist, wasn't he?
Well, he was. He was a faint-hearted segregationist, but definitely he was. And that is to say that in his first year in office, his administration, therefore he, introduced Jim Crow into federal offices, specifically the Department of Treasury and the Post Office. And that, of course, sanctioned any department in any state that so chose to segregate. It was something Wilson did, I think, largely for political reasons. As soon as he came into office with this very ambitious progressive agenda, the Southern Bloc, which was really a third of the senators and the congressmen on whom Wilson really depended to carry his measures, made it quite clear that his new freedom, his program, was going nowhere if he intended to do anything about advancing race relations. And so the issue of segregation came up very early. He had several real segregationists and genuine overt racists in his cabinet. And it was also the age, to remind you, this was 100 years ago, where Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal, was very much in effect in this country. And Wilson's real belief, I think, was not about keeping one race down. He didn't have a problem with African Americans. I think Wilson really believed in his heart that the country simply wasn't ready to integrate. This, you know, as you pointed out, was somebody who grew up in the South, had history in the South, and this was a time where there were still people who remembered the Civil War very well, who had fought in the Civil War, people still refighting the Civil War, trying to make things the way they used to be. Wilson was not one of those, but he knew there were enough of those such that integration at that time was going to be pretty violent.
America's eventual involvement in World War I, which Wilson was able to put off for most of his first term, to make the world safe for democracy, as he puts it. That policy hasn't changed a whole lot in a century, has it?
Well, I'd say it hasn't changed at all. And if anybody has paid attention to the news in the last week, you will hear how little it has changed. There was President Obama last week talking about Syria and talking about America's role in dealing with Syria. And all the questions he was asking, should the United States become the policeman of the world? Does the United States have a moral obligation when it sees gross injustice, when it sees 1,000 people being gassed to death, when children are dying because of inhumanity? Does the United States have a certain moral responsibility? With greatness, does there come that responsibility? Those were all questions Woodrow Wilson asked in 1917 in his most famous speech, really, in which he asked Congress to declare war on Germany and uttered the phrase, "The world must be made safe for democracy." And that one sentence has really been the cornerstone of American foreign policy, for good or for bad, whether you agree with or disagree with it. But it has been the cornerstone for the last century.
Was that foreign policy, making the world safe for democracy, consistent with Wilson's domestic policy? I think about the Espionage Act, the Palmer raids eventually. We've got to round up the domestic threats, the threats to democracy here at home.
Well, I think you're exactly right to ask the question, because I don't think it was consistent. And Wilson was not always consistent. In his mind, he somehow found ways to be. But I would say one of the blackest marks in his administration was his reintroducing Alien and Sedition Acts that he felt Lincoln and Adams had done in their times in office. But here, Wilson was, no question about it, suppressing free speech. He was having people imprisoned, most notably Eugene Debs, the great socialist, who even ran against Wilson a few times for the presidency. And Wilson just felt this was something he had to do. He felt there was an international threat in the way of anarchy and this rising thing called communism. And he just came down really hard on it, to the extent that Debs gave a speech that was ruled seditious. He went to prison, served several years, and the final moments of Wilson's administration, even the people who had put him away in jail, went to Wilson and said, "Won't you pardon him now? He's in his 70s. He's ill. He has served several years. The war is over. Can't we let him out?" And Wilson refused to sign that pardon.
What about President Wilson's health? You recount in your book that there were warning signs throughout his life that he was at risk for, well, eventually a major stroke.
Well, here's the advantage the biographer has 100 years later that the doctors didn't have then, especially 100 years ago when they didn't know as much about strokes as we now do. But I could piece together the fact that he was having small strokes as far back as really his 30s and 40s when he was starting out his career as a college professor. And there are growing incidents along the way, including some, I should add, when Wilson left the United States for 6 months, as he did as president, to go to Paris to negotiate the great peace after World War I, which was meant to incorporate his 14 points in his League of Nations. And during that period, there were moments of truly aberrant behavior, which we can now really attribute to cerebral incidents, to minor strokes, such that indeed, he was a time bomb just waiting to explode. And explode he did in the middle of his great cross-country tour trying to convince America to endorse the League of Nations. And he was rushed back to the White House and suffered a major stroke some days later.
So for the last, year and a half of his presidency, Wilson's an invalid in the White House. He's guarded by his wife, Edith. How much authority did she really have?
Well, she had a great deal of authority in that basically nobody could see or communicate otherwise with the President of the United States without going through Edith Galt Wilson, the second Mrs. Wilson, whom he married upon the death of his first wife. So she would claim that she was nothing more than a steward, that she never did anything that her husband would not have done or thought anything he would not have thought. That being said, she was the one who basically decided who, among the very few, got to see the president and which issues he would decide upon. She basically presented all the arguments to him of any document she deemed important enough for the president of the United States to deal with. So some might say she was acting as a kind of super chief of staff, which to some extent she was, but here and there you wonder where does she cross over that line, and I try to detail that in the book.
Why wasn't there a push to have Vice President Thomas Marshall assume the presidency? Was he left left in the dark too?
There were a couple of reasons. Thomas R. Marshall from Indiana, who was vice president, was considered one of the most lovable and beloved figures in the United States, but he was also a bit of a buffoon. And the rumor was that when they finally did tell him that the president had suffered a stroke, the rumor was that he fainted. This was a man who was really not presidential timber. That being said, there was, as I chronicle in the book, a genuine conspiracy in the White House between Mrs. Wilson and the doctors that decided that they should not tell Thomas R. Marshall. And who's to say that he might not have risen to the occasion? He was a politically savvy fellow. Who's to say he might not have become a Harry Truman, who just needed the chance, who needed some light to shine upon him in order to grow? As a result of that, we have an amendment to the Constitution that very clearly defines presidential disability, and that grows largely out of the Wilson case.
You know, most high school history courses characterize Wilson's second term as a disappointing failure for him personally, his stroke notwithstanding, because the U.S. Senate failed to ratify the Versailles Treaty and the League of Nations contained therein, which Wilson advocated for. But Wilson was able to accomplish many, if not all, of his other goals or reasons for entering World War I, wasn't he?
Well, there's no question about that. And one also has to remember this. He was an extremely successful wartime president. He not only mobilized this country, which was basically an isolationist nation with an army at that point the size of that of Portugal, he conveyed 2 million men overseas, and I'm not talking about crossing the Hellespont here, we're talking about crossing the Atlantic Ocean, and waged an extremely successful war in which relatively few, and I don't want to dismiss more than 100,000 Americans, but compared to the tens of millions who died in Europe, Wilson was very successful at that. And indeed, so much of the rest of his 14 points were enacted in the treaty. And as a result of that, as a result of Wilson's second term, the United States really did emerge the first great modern superpower of the world, militarily, economically, and every other which way, politically.
Would you count Wilson among America's greatest presidents? Does he deserve a seat at the table with Washington, Lincoln, FDR?
I think I would. I would put him in that group, and I should say that until the last half of the 20th century, Wilson was always in that top group with Washington, Jefferson, and Lincoln. And I would say, and this is probably the result of his views on race, which as America was finally confronting the race issue in the way Wilson thought it would be dealt with, as he said, a generation or two after me, I think he looked archaic and he came down a few pegs. But I think when you look at the Wilson career, when you look at the Wilson influence in its totality, you will see that this really was the giant of the century. This was the man even FDR modeled himself after, the one that Harry Truman called the greatest of the greats. The president, ironically, that when Richard Nixon became president of the United States, he asked that Woodrow Wilson's desk be moved into the Oval Office so that he could work at it.
A number of books have been written about the 28th president. For this book, though, you had access to some new primary source material. How'd that come about?
I did. It's quite amazing to think that here's a subject dead almost 100 years, and yet new primary sources are still surfacing. It's quite remarkable. But in two cases, I was given access to recently discovered trunks of papers. One set of trunks belonged to Woodrow Wilson's daughter, and when her last child died recently, his family found thousands and thousands of personal letters, family letters, that she had written and received to her husband, to her father, Woodrow Wilson, and to people in her life, which revealed so much about the personal side of Wilson. And then, similarly, Dr. Carrie T. Grayson, who had been Wilson's personal physician and closest confidant, when his last son died a few years ago, there again they discovered trunkloads full of papers, notes he had taken on his famous patient, letters to his wife in which he talked very personally about what was going on with both President Wilson and Mrs. Wilson, whom he had introduced to the president. So it was just a gold mine of the stuff biographers dream about, which is personal documents that really let me show you not just the mind of my subject, but the way his heart beat.
For an historian, it's like winning the lottery, isn't it?
Well, it totally is. And then to win it twice is really something. And it just allowed me to flesh him out. And that, I have always felt, was the hardest thing in writing about Woodrow Wilson, because so much that has written about him has been so cold and scholarly. And what I wanted to do was write a very personal book about President Wilson. I wanted you to see what the presidency was like from the inside. What is it like to walk into the White House for the first time, having his personal background, and play that story out? How did history unfold before his eyes?
I read, maybe in the PR release, you've been working on this for 13 years. Is that true?
That is true. And in some ways, I've been working on it for about 30 years before that. I read my first book about Woodrow Wilson when I was 15, and I became utterly infatuated, perhaps at 15, with the tragic idealism of Woodrow Wilson. But increasingly, I became interested in the fact that this was the most meteoric rise in American history. So I was rather fascinated about how and why that came about. And increasingly, I saw the great influence this man was exerting over not just his time, but the next 100 years. And as we've already discussed, here we are now talking about issues that Woodrow Wilson first put on the table.
Word is that Warner Brothers has acquired the rights, the movie rights to your book. Is that true? Is that true, Mr. Berg?
Well, you are very up to date, because yes, this just hit the internet and the airwaves about 24 hours ago. And yes, sometimes there is truth to rumor, and this is one of those occasions. Yes, Leonardo DiCaprio and his production company and Warner Brothers have taken the book, and we are now going to start working on a film.
Does that mean that DiCaprio will star as Woodrow Wilson?
It's very conceivably that. I think it will be his decision, but the basic answer to that question is yes. And strangely, I think he could be a thrilling Woodrow Wilson. First of all, I think he's a wonderful actor, but second of all, there are very few actors who can convey both intelligence and deep emotion. And I think those are the two most important characteristics in order to capture Woodrow Wilson.
A. Scott Berg is the author of Wilson, recently published. Mr. Berg, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
The pleasure's been mine. Thank you.